Okay, so this paragraph that begins, this opens the way for other explanations which make consciousness the creator of this world, which starts about, it's the third paragraph from the one that we are beginning today. And essentially, there what Sri Aurobindo is looking at is three explanations. One is the explanation of a transcendent God, that is a creator. And this is the common notion, particularly the Western notion, of a creator and a creation. The two separate from each other, the creator controlling the creation. This feeds into our common knowledge or common assumptions about God. You know, God is somebody who is outside of the creation, transcendent, and in a way controlling the creation from above. The other possibility that he introduces is that of an immanent God, immanent, in other words, one who has entered the creation, but still is sort of like a layer separated from the dynamic evolution. So controlling it from within, but separated from it. So it's really a immanent or transcendent layer within the immanent. This is how some philosophers have categorized that kind of position. And he finds a problem with both of them. At least if one is to give a complete understanding or a sufficiently complete understanding, neither the first nor the second nor the two of them together suffice. And the reason is, of course, that a separated entity, in a sense, would not be able to experience what is going on inside the cosmos. And that's the reason why he, towards the end of that paragraph, he introduces the crux of the difficulty. He says, though we could even assume that such a transcendence above or within can intervene in this creation, the intervening of this evolving consciousness would not be a difficulty, since there would be no contradiction of the basic nature of things in its appearance. An omnipotent God could easily infuse something of itself into its creatures. In other words, from above it comes in and impels its creatures with its own qualities, if and when needed. But this is the crux of the difficulty. He says one difficulty remains. It is the arbitrary nature of the creation, the incomprehensibility of its purpose, the crude meaninglessness of its law of unnecessary ignorance, strife and suffering, its ending without a denouement or issue, a play. But why this stamp of so many undivine elements and characters in the play of one whose nature must be supposed to be divine? To the suggestion that what we see worked out in the world is the thoughts of God, the retort can be made that God could well have had better thoughts. And the best thought of all would have been to refrain from the creation of an unhappy and unintelligible universe. All theistic explanations of existence, starting from an extra-cosmic deity, stumble over this difficulty and can only evade it. It would disappear only if the creator were, even though exceeding the creation, yet immanent in it, himself in some sort both the player and the play, an infinite casting infinite possibilities into the set form of an evolutionary cosmic order. So here the idea is, and this notion of a creator-creation duality, whether transcendent or immanent, is what has been called hylomorphism. Hylomorphism is a term that has been used also to describe the Platonic notion of a division between a soul and a body, now as completely distinct entities. Now, what is being talked about here is that whatever we see in the material reality is God. In other words, that totality of existence, consciousness, bliss is present here as matter. So, from that point of view, a certain kind of play opens up in which the forgetting, the self-forgetting of God is the basis for a graded and phased evolution in which it recovers itself. Now, the self-recovery is something that it could be aided by a transcendent and or imminent extra-cosmic entity, but that aid does not come in and by itself. It is only through relation, and that relation is primarily something which is dependent on forms of agency within whatever we call the creation. So the creation is God Himself, the player and the play at the same time. One certain way of talking about this, again, which comes from Plato, is in terms of the memory. So for Plato, this creation, the creation, the created world, carries within itself a memory, because it has ultimately descended from a world of ideas, as he calls it, the Platonic ideas. So it retains the memory of its origin and strives to recover or recollect that memory. That kind of notion also exists in a variety of forms, and if we try to look at it even from a Vedantic point of view, in terms of time, we can talk about memory, because memory always assumes a past which is trying to be recovered. But if we talk about it as a intrinsic immanence, which means that the totality is present in each of its elements, not extra cosmic, but within each of its elements, then even to talk of memory is not an accurate representation. It is more like degrees and forms of access. It is as if the whatever we call the creation is Brahman presenting itself to itself with different degrees and forms of access to its own truth. So this is how Sri Aurobindo looks upon whatever we are experiencing as the cosmos. Now, from there he develops the rest of the paragraphs that we have covered, which is that as he begins the next paragraph, as he says, on that hypothesis there must be behind the action of the material energy a secret involved consciousness, cosmic, infinite, building up through the action of that frontal energy its means of an evolutionary manifestation, a creation out of itself in the boundless finite of the material universe. The apparent inconscience of the material energy would be an indispensable condition for the structure of the material world substance in which this consciousness intends to involve itself, so that it may grow by evolution out of its apparent opposite. For without some such device, a complete involution would be impossible. So this is the point, that the device of this kind of self-appearance, the self-appearance of Brahman as matter, is undertaken as a kind of systematic exploration of itself, the infinite exploring itself perennially, forever. And that can happen. Every cosmos, every possible manifestation is of that kind. But if there is a principle of intelligence working within that self-exploration that allows it to look upon itself in a structured form, in other words, how are we systematically going to explore what it is that we are, then there has to be a method to it. And the method has to begin with the positing of a zero. This zero is the self-oblivion of God. God completely negating itself and appearing as its opposite. So that from that may arise, through its own self-remembrance in each of its parts, the recovery of God. And in the process, the systematic, graded and phased understanding or knowledge of the divine manifested as a play. Now, the notion of a play also is very important, because it's not merely the self-oblivion of God as a single substance, as a cosmos, but also a fragmentation of the original unity into its infinite particles. So it is the particulation of God. It is the way by which the one obscures or hides its oneness and releases or loses itself in its infinity. So infinity, discreteness, because the discreteness is that which makes infinity real, and the unconsciousness, inconscience, are the characteristics of ground zero from which an evolution may begin, and through which each of these infinite possibilities of the divine may assume separate independent status, so that there can be a play and B, an evolution that unfolds systematically the powers and properties of the divine. So this is the basis that Sri Aurobindo lays out. And in this, what he's pointing out is that each of these particles, unconscious particles, is the entirety of Brahman, entirety of what it is that we call the divine. And hence, each of them has agency, those and forms of access and degrees of access to its own complete truth. Each of them is the complete truth, and each of them has different degrees of access to its own reality, so that both from within as well as from its own self-consciousness, it is contacting and manifesting that one. Now, because of the self-oblivion and because of the different degrees of remembrance, it takes on the appearance of a unsure movement, a trial and error movement, which nevertheless, through its hesitating steps, is moving, because it is containing within itself the truth, towards the full manifestation of the truth. Now, it is important to see that this idea is not the same as intelligent design, nor is it the same as Darwinism in terms of evolution. Darwinism is purely based on material chance, and so the randomness is creating forms of adaptation which are more and more adaptable, but it says nothing about the adaptation housing a more adequate consciousness. There is a power of individuation at work. It is as if the one is reconstituting itself in the each through the evolution. Now, on the other hand, in intelligent design, we come up with the extra-cosmic divine problem. The intelligent design is supposing that something or someone has created a world in which things are perfectly maintained. While what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that this is the self-appearance of Brahman, and no extra cosmic divine is actually doing anything to it, unless agency within this creation itself is calling on that to help it, which is also a possibility, and he, as he says, that is part of the mechanism. But it isn't that something has made it do what it is, maintain it, its own condition. I think with that we can move to where we are, because in these two paragraphs, I'd also sort of draw attention to one or two more passages in these two paragraphs. At the end of that particular paragraph, where he's talking about the inconscience of the material energy as an indispensable condition, he says, the principle of truths, real powers of the infinite imperatively fulfilling themselves, would be the explanation of the opposite aspect of a mechanical necessity which we see in nature. Okay, before that he's talking of the chance. So this kind, that's the reason why there's a randomness and a sense of chance, because it begins with the self-forgetting. But within the self-forgetting is what we may provisionally call a memory, or as I called it, a certain degree or level of access, which gives that, which is the principle of truth. And the principle of truth is allowing it to develop a kind of necessity, the notion of a necessity. This part is also very important, where he's talking about the truths of powers of the being. So if there is such a creation by the infinite out of itself, it must be the manifestation in a material disguise of truths or powers of its own being. The forms of vehicles of these truths or powers would be the basic general or fundamental determinants we see in nature. The particular determinants, which otherwise are unaccountable variations that have emerged from the vague general stuff in which they originate, would be the appropriate forms or vehicles of the possibilities that the truths or powers residing in these fundamentals bore within them. So, everything here is really a form of this self-manifestation and manifestation of the truths and powers of the divine. So here, as we can see, as has already been pointed out, through the primary sort of dichotomy that Sri Aurobindo has introduced, these dichotomies or these paradoxes, like the paradox of chance and necessity, for example, or the paradox of the one and the many, for example, which have already been introduced, these are the truths of God. The truths of God are truths because the one is infinite, because the one can see itself both as material as well as completely conscious, or put out other words, both as subject and as object. So these forms of these truths are manifesting in an evolutionary fashion, and that's the reason why this notion of individuation, the ability of each entity in the cosmos to manifest and strive towards a certain degree which marks its limit of the fullness of the solution to these paradoxical ideas or truths, that is, in a sense, the drive of the evolution. This also puts another spin on the notion of the Platonic ideas. So Platonic ideas, which are considered to be transcendent and from which we are supposed to have descended, leaving them behind, is seen very differently from this conception. From this conception, ideas exist. These ideas, which form the, which are the truths of God, open up a field of evolution, a field of problems of evolution that are being worked out and moving towards their fulfillment in each entity and particle of the cosmos. All the unexplained processes of nature would find their meaning and their place if this hypothesis proved to be tenable. that's the next paragraph, and there he's talking about energy and form, and how these two things, form and energy, because this discreteness of self-presentation is the way in which substance becomes form, but is held together by energy. And he shows how these two, again, that opens up another area of paradoxical idea, that these two correlate or correspond to the two original constituents that have entered for the purpose of this evolution, sat and chit, of being or existence and consciousness. Form is existence or sat, and energy is consciousness or force, conscious force. So it is the play of these that maintains this evolution. And form is always, therefore, significant form. Form always carries within itself a certain quality. That's the idea element that is completely missed out in a Darwinian evolution, where form is only material adaptation. So he says, one begins to understand also how arrangement of design, quantity and number can be a base for the manifestation of quality and property. For design, quantity and number are powers of existence substance. Quality and property are powers of the consciousness and its force that reside in the existence. They can then be made manifest and operative by a rhythm and process of substance. The growth of the tree out of the seed would be accounted for, like all other similar phenomena, by the indwelling presence of what we have called the real idea, the infinite self-perception of the significant form, the living body of its power of existence that has to emerge from its own self-compression in energy substance, would be carried internally in the form of the seed, carried in the occult consciousness involved in that form, and would naturally evolve out of it. So this kind of example that Sri Aurobindo gives is also showing us how that central idea, the real idea, is manifest both as symbol and as literal property of evolution in each of its constituents. So, for example, in the symbol or in the manifestation of the ever-repeating perpetuity of the tree and the seed, which is essentially what in medieval philosophy used to be called a perpetual motion machine. Kind of that solves that a certain kind of a paradox. Again, that's an idea. These are the real ideas of involution and evolution that are manifest in symbolic form to the extent possible by that particular kind of gradation of consciousness that is exploring the completeness of the various possibilities of divine existence and consciousness. And then towards the end,
Devashish?
Yeah.
Can I ask you, when we're talking about consciousness force, and when we're talking about energy, and we're talking about the form and not form, which of these is the Shiva and which is the Shakti? Which is the feminine and which is the masculine?
In that translation that you're talking about, it's sat or existence or substance, which is the Shiva, and it's energy, which is the Shakti.
Okay, because I always thought that form was more of the feminine, and it's a combination of both.
Everything is a combination, but in this particular way of seeing, all form is a manifestation of sat. So, as a matter of fact, if you look at it symbolically, since you raised that issue, in the Shaivite traditions, Shiva is Shava, in other words, corpse, in other words, form. Shiva is matter itself. And Shakti is the energy that is inhabiting that matter.
Right.
Yeah. So, form is the existence power, its existence of being, pure being. Just like matter is pure being. Matter is being that seems to be devoid of consciousness. And that's why it is Shiva. And within it is Shakti. Shakti is that which makes it animated and gives it its various kinds of forms. So that's perhaps what you meant by form, you thought was Shakti, because the significance of form, the quality of form, is given to it by Shakti.
Ah. So consciousness force here, yeah, would be more of like Shiva. Would be more of of Shakti.
Yes.
And the energy or manifestation of the force would be more of Shiva.
Not the energy, but the substance on which, yeah, the energy is working.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That makes sense. And when you're talking about involution and evolution, unless I didn't hear everything from the last one, I think I missed the last 15 or 20 minutes, but are there keywords that we should look for when thinking of involution and evolution? And have you gone over much of involution yet, or are we getting to that?
Yeah, at this point, he's only laying out those possibilities as truths, that this is, as he says, indeterminates and cosmic determinations, that that is what is behind this particular creation. What we call the creation is an involution evolution perpetual motion machine. This is what it is, because consciousness is exploring the powers of being in a systematic, graded and phased manner. And so that and it's doing that in all the various ways in which the infinity of substance can present itself. So that's exactly the way by which Brahman is presenting itself to itself as this cosmos.
So, because I just, maybe I'm kind of asking for a distinction between evolution and involution. Is involution more of the secret occult fabric that has been woven into everything that's latent and that's awakening?
You could call it that. So basically, as this very line that I just read about the tree and the seed is a good, because the tree and the seed, as he presents it, is a wonderful symbol for the involution evolution, right? And as he points out over here, the infinite self-perception of the significant form, the living body of its power of existence, that has to emerge from its own self-compression in energy substance. That term, that phrase, self-compression in energy substance, translates as involution. And the has to emerge is the evolution, would be carried internally in the form of the seed. Just as he's giving the example of the seed of the tree, this whole cosmos is a seed. And every entity in it is a seed. Every being in it is a seed, which is a self-compression in energy substance of the real idea. And therefore, the truths must emerge from it. You see?
So the emerge is the evolution part.
Correct.
And then the self-compression in energy substance is in.
Yeah. What he has not introduced as yet, because of course it's a long exploration or long exposition, you may say, is that the sense of that, the kind of way by which these various levels or grades of consciousness are laid out is through limitations placed by consciousness on being. So each one of these, like matter and the various variations of matter, life, the various variations of life, etc., are properties. That's part of the qualia, the qualities of energy that bind being. And those properties are going to allow only certain forms of these or degrees of these problems to be solved. And that is what will allow this graded and phased quality to emerge. Now, that the matter doesn't end there, because if it did, then what we would have are all these manifestations that would be completely static. But nothing is static. You know, everything is evolving, and it's evolving at two levels. One is it's evolving in terms of these variations of any determinate. Every determinate that he's talking about is at another level and indeterminate. And it's being determined by its variations. And at the same time, within it is some principle which is evolving from form to form, carrying with it this evolution of the various degrees of substance manifestation. Those are the souls. So he hasn't yet brought that in. And so I don't want to jump ahead, but since you asked the question, I'm laying out these two kinds of evolutions that are going on. The evolution of Prakriti and the evolution of Purusha. They are two different evolutions. Yes. Both of them are going on.
Thank you.
So I think with that we can begin the new paragraph on the same basis. But if anybody else has any comments or questions, this is a good time to enter into it.
Hi, Devashish. I also have a question. This is John Robert.
Yeah, John.
It seems like to me that he's laying out a rational argument here for the view that he's espousing, and I wonder if you think he considers that the rational argument sufficient to establish. I mean, or is it just he's putting it into a rational form because that's more amenable to modern consciousness?
Very good question, John Robert. I don't think he's... First answer to your first question is, I don't think he thinks it is sufficient to establish an explanation on the basis of this rational presentation. More profoundly, he is not particularly interested in laying out a single explanation in and for itself. Both as a kind of a, you know, sort of an end, why does he want to do this, as well as a explanation, a sufficient cause for the explanation, he's going to draw on experience. So as I pointed out earlier, his methodology is to follow an intuition first. So this is intuition as method, in a way. So the intuition is being fine-tuned and emerging as a reason. And then he will use that reason to answer the question, how should we lead our lives? That is really at the basis of it. And in this very chapter, you'll see, as he moves on, he's going to draw attention to forms of experience that will validate what he's talking about.
Okay, thank you very much.
And then the other thing that one must notice is that, again, Sri Aurobindo is coming out of a Vedantic tradition in which the text of darshan, of philosophy, cannot be separated from the text of yoga. So that's the reason why a book like The Life Divine has to be seen simultaneously with a work like The Synthesis of Yoga. The two are two wings of what he's trying to do.
Okay, thank you.
Devashish,
yeah.
This formation thing that which the earlier person who was raising that issue about this form, whether that is relates to that feminine that shakti.
Yes.
So this formation, it feels to me is like little tricky to say that the form is the substance. I mean, it is true at the same time, isn't it? Like if you look at it from the phenomenal point of view,
yes.
Like form has both. Actually, I'm just saying, like, you correct me if I'm wrong, that it has its substance which makes it.
Right.
At the same time, it has its phenomenon.
Yeah.
Which is sort of Maya creation, or whatever you call it.
Right, right.
So that way, form actually includes both.
Yeah.
Right.
No doubt. Well, what I would say is that if you separate the two, pure substance is being, or in the theistic conception, Shiva, while pure consciousness is Shakti. Now the two are one, of course, but then once we separate them and talk about it as a play of Ishvara and Shakti, then that enters into the, when the energy sort of starts making its play with substance, then we start having forms. So any form is already a particular combination of Shiva and Shakti. Shiva form giving the substance, and Shakti actually giving it its significant form. So every form has significance, and its qualities, etc., and the way in which it is held together is all through the power of Shakti. So yeah, indeed, there is nothing in which Shiva and Shakti are not both involved in each other.
Thank you. And one more thing, it's just a comment sort of about this, imminent, this thing. I was just thinking of this, this matter and energy.
Yes.
If you keep them separate, it's easy to sort of explain, energy is communicating between two material things. But like in physics, physicists, they took the challenge of actually trying to explain energy also.
Yes.
In terms of something explainable, which is matter.
Yes.
Or definable. So that there, finally, they came to the same point, which is coming in this logic also, that until and unless you have that entire knowledge within each of its elements,
yes,
you cannot really make any communication. In other words, like action at a distance, which is very,
yes,
popular in physics,
yes, yes,
that actually is possible only when the two points which are acting on each other,
yes,
have the total knowledge of action and themselves as well.
Yes, true, very true, very true. In fact, we could take this further even into the realm of living things, and I was mentioning that there is a certain very famous Nobel Prize biologist, Jacques Monod. And Jacques Monod wrote a book called Chance and Necessity, which was a groundbreaking book, because that was one of the most important ways by which Darwinism was taken to the molecular level. He was trying to prove that even at the molecular level, Darwinian evolutionary processes can be explained. But as he explained it, there were ways by which he had to invoke memory. So ultimately, in fact, that's one of the kind of really important contributions of that work. It ended up being, one of the things that he's talking about is that at the genetic level, there are forms of memory, not just code, but memory, through which chemicals are repeating behaviors that seem completely otherwise unexplainable. It's as if they are remembering behaviors, and they are also remembering the totality of what is being done, so that they behave unconventionally whenever necessary, so that the aim is fulfilled. So yes, I think these are all ways by which the coexistence of energy and substance and the totality are validated, I think.
Thank you.
Devashish?
Yes.
I don't want to stray too much, but in that example, how would memory differ? Wouldn't memory be an aspect of intelligence also?
Yeah, it would be an aspect of intelligence. But as I said right in the beginning, actually I think memory, the word memory is used a lot, but memory doesn't really very well, it is intelligence, no doubt. I mean, even if we say that memory is constrained by time, well, we are talking about access. In other words, a better explanation would be that everything has a certain degree of access to the truth, and it exercises it. And some have a greater power of access, and some have a lesser power of access. But potentially, everything can access the truth. And then, yes, it is a form of intelligence.
Thank you.
Everything is immanent with intelligence as well, you know. And of the the Enlightenment philosophers, the one that came closest to this kind of a view, which is why he's being revived so much now, is Baruch Spinoza. Spinoza thought of matter as thinking matter, that whatever we call matter has all the properties of God within it. And that is, in a sense, what's being asserted here as well.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yes.
So we are on page 318 in my book, and I think the other version, the book, the page number is 304. This is the paragraph starting with all the unexplained processes. Matteo, would you like to read?
Sure, can you hear me?
I think we finished that one, right?
Start with on the same basis?
Yeah, on the same basis. Isn't that the case, Shyam? I think that's what you said.
Sure.
Yeah.
On the same basis, there would be no difficulty in understanding why the physiological functionings of the body help to determine the mind's psychological actions. For the body is not mere unconscious matter. It is a structure of a secretly conscious energy that has taken form in it. Itself occultly conscious, it is, at the same time, the vehicle of expression of an overt consciousness that has emerged and is self-aware in our physical energy substance. The body's functionings are a necessary machinery or instrumentation for the movements of this mental inhabitant. It is only by setting the corporeal instrument in motion that the conscious being emerging, evolving in it, can transmit its mind formations, will formations, and turn them into a physical manifestation of itself in matter. The capacity, the process of the instrument must, to a certain extent, reshape the mind formations in their transition from mental shape into physical expression. Its workings are necessary and must exercise their influence before that expression can become actual. The bodily instrument may even in some directions dominate its user. It may too, by a force of habit, suggest or create involuntary reactions of the consciousness inhabiting it before the working mind and will can control or interfere. All this is possible because the body has a subconscient consciousness of its own, which counts in our total self-expression. Even if we look at this outer instrumentation only, we can conclude that body determines mind. But this is only a minor truth, and the major truth is that mind determines body. In this view, a still deeper truth becomes conceivable. A spiritual entity ensouling the substance that veils it is the original determinant of both body, mind, of both mind and body. On the other side, in the opposite order of process, that by which the mind can transmit its ideas and commands to the body can train it to be an instrument for new action, can even so impress it with its habitual demands or orders that the physical instinct carries them out automatically, even when the mind is no longer consciously willing them. Those also more unusual but well attested, by which to an extraordinary and hardly limitable extent, the mind can learn to determine the reactions of the body, even to the overriding of its normal law or conditions of action. These and other otherwise unaccountable aspects of the relation between these two elements of our being become easily understandable. For it is the secret consciousness in the living matter that receives from its greater companion. It is this in the body that in its own involved and occult fashion perceives or feels the demand on it and obeys the emerged or evolved consciousness which presides over the body. Finally, the conception of a divine mind and will creating the cosmos becomes justifiable, while at the same time the perplexing elements in which our reasoning mentality refuses to ascribe to an arbitrary fiat of the Creator find their explanation as inevitable phenomena of a consciousness emerging with difficulty out of its opposite, but with the mission to override these contrary phenomena and manifest by a slow and difficult evolution its greater reality and true nature.
So, as we see here, Sri Aurobindo is laying out in his own way the mind-body problem. You see, this is the old mind-body problem, and in Western metaphysics, this has remained an insuperable problem. Sometimes people want to overcome it by talking about, you know, that there is no distinction between mind and body, that we have to look at mind as, you know, a form of body, that it's the intelligence of the body. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing to, or else there is the big schism between mind and body, which the Cartesian, you know, sort of enlightenment project has introduced us to. And there we subordinate body to mind. Mind becomes equated to consciousness. In fact, the word consciousness in the general Western, you know, sort of rational tradition is completely identified with mind, while the body is considered to be unconscious. So what he's pointing out here is that immanent in everything is the completeness of the totality of the truth. But each one of these, depending on the consciousness that is creating the gradation of reality, is a different degree of access. So there is a secret occult consciousness present in the body. The body is also a structure of consciousness. And yet, that structure of consciousness has only a certain degree of agency. because it isn't able to, if we use that temporal term, remember beyond a certain point. It has a ceiling to its memory as it is constituted, given the conditions of the energy that is working inside it. But other gradations can emerge out of the evolution of that particular structure. And the life force emerges within body, the mind emerges within body, it creates its own organ for housing itself and using as a connection between the mind and body. Now, each one of these principles that emerges is like the other ones, a gradation of consciousness and a kind of consciousness. So to Brahman, these are differences in degree, but to Prakriti, there are also differences in kind. Each one has radically different properties, and the chief property, mode of difference, is the degree of access. There is a radically new degree of access to truth. And so this is where the notion of higher and lower emerges. The notion of higher and lower, as he says over here, he uses the term receives from its grace. For it is the secret consciousness in the living matter that receives from its greater companion. This word greater over here refers exactly to this greater degree of access that Prakriti allows the emerging forms of consciousness in matter. And so each one of these again is a complete gradation. In mind, the entirety of Brahman is present, but in a certain self-presentation. In matter, the entirety of Brahman is present, but in a certain kind of self-presentation. And so what the complexity of the formulation that Sri Aurobindo is giving us is that these are not exclusive to each other. They are based in each other and they are influencing each other. They even have ways by which they allow the growth of each other. And as you will point out, that's part of the reason why in this particular scheme nothing remains static, and ultimately we envisage a complete divinization, not only of the more conscious elements, but of the least conscious elements as well.
And the least conscious elements would be in the inconscient.
Correct.
Part of
absolutely. Absolutely. Just like our body itself is the least conscious element of the living substance that he's talking about, so too that would extend even further down to inconscient, inorganic matter, and even further down to levels of subjective inconscience.
Right, and in the which is essentially the unconscious. And I can't help but think about, you know, Carl Jung and the unconscious, and how his whole kind of mission was to reawaken the unconscious within us. And so I'm kind of looking at it from a parallel view in a sense, not a perfect match, but,
Owen, I think, that's a very good point. But we have to be, one thing we have to be careful about is that there's a big difference between the inconscient and the unconscious. The unconscious that you're talking about in Carl Jung has nothing to do with the inconscient. It is not even less conscious than the body. The Carl Jung's unconscious is just that which is not in waking consciousness. In the Indian tradition, we have four forms of consciousness: the waking, the what is called the sleeping. But what is called the sleeping is what Carl Jung would call the unconscious. And then we have the one that rises beyond the two, which is the one called Prajna. And that's the one that Sri Aurobindo will call supermind. So what Carl Jung calls the unconscious are all the occult layers of subjective universal consciousness up to what Sri Aurobindo calls overmind. It has nothing to do with the inconscient.
So the in... Right, because the inconscient... within the inconscient is the superconscious.
In the case of Carl Jung, yeah. In the case of Carl Jung. But in the inconscient, of course, by inconscient is meant the forms of latent consciousness in matter, for example. Matter is the manifestation of the inconscient because consciousness doesn't seem to be present in it. You see? But that doesn't mean that it is a subjective consciousness that has fallen asleep. It is, in a way it is, but it is not in the same way that access to the subjective consciousness is available to the mind in dream, which would become the unconscious of the psychologists.
Right. There's a much, much deeper level of access.
Yes.
I would also say, Dave Ashish, that I'm persuaded to think about the book here, or about in this paragraph in particular, neuroplasticity comes to mind, where we have the mind, neurons that fire together, neurons that wire together, fire together with a wire together, and then it's that the body creates the mind, but what neuroplasticity has shown us is that the mind also creates the body.
And also
epigenetics has shown us that we are not a victim of our genes, that we can actually change them through our mind. Change our DNA, influence it at least, and
influence it, not change it, because again, each mind is not God, just as body is not God. Yes, they are both potentially God. There is nothing but God, but the level of access of mind doesn't allow it to change body beyond a certain point. Say, for example, in the movie Matrix, where you're being shown that by mind power you can actually completely do whatever you want with the body, that is a stretch which can only be understood symbolically. That cannot actually happen. It can happen only at a much higher level. That's the reason why one has to respect the boundaries that each one of these forms of consciousness are given by the energy or consciousness that is constituting them. At supermind, yes. Everything is a structure of supramental substance, including mind. But mind influences body and can change it to a certain degree, but not completely.
Yes, thank you.
These things are important to acknowledge because it becomes a New Age myth. That body is nothing but mind. This is the way in which a lot of New Age teachers try to propagate this or even in a certain sense solve the mind-body problem by reducing body to mind, and cannot be reduced to mind.
Wow.
Like this access level, can it also be said that these different gradations, this material principle and mental principle, they are at different stages of fragmentation, meaning the concretization of division?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Different stages of the concretization of division, and that's the reason why inconscience is necessary, because it is the complete loss of consciousness and the complete fragmentation of being. And then out of that, we are having assemblages that can make complexity possible and recreate the minimum conditions under which subjective consciousness can emerge. But once subjective consciousness emerges, say in the form of life or in the form of mind, these are greater degrees that have more wholeness to them as well as more agency to them. That is, more of the totality of that which is God can be experienced and accessed in a seamless fashion by them. So that's the reason why in Sri Aurobindo's terminology, each one of these gradations of consciousness houses a different relationship between Purusha and Prakriti. The relationship between Purusha and Prakriti is different at each of the, that is what characterizes these particular levels.
Thank you.
This point will become very important also as we continue, because Sri Aurobindo will point to the fact that, again, answering to some extent John Roberts' question, how are we to verify this? Can we verify it? We can. He says, yes, we can verify it. But to verify it, we have to seek that in which that particular access is possible, through which the verification is possible. And that can only be done to a provisional amount, given the instruments we have right now. But then operating on these instruments, we can release something through which we can know. That's the point that he's going to make.
Shall we read the next?
Sure.
Dan Wood, would you like to read the next one?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. See, but an approach, that's the paragraph, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But an approach from the material end of existence cannot give us any certitude of validity for this hypothesis, or for that matter, or any other explanation of nature and her procedure. The veil cast by the original unconscious is too thick for the mind to pierce, and it is behind this veil that is hidden the secret origination of what is manifested. There are seated the truths and powers underlying the phenomena and processes that appear to us in the material front of nature. To know with greater certitude, we must follow the curve of evolving consciousness until it arrives at a height and largeness of self-enlightenment in which the primal secret is self-discovered. For presumably, it must evolve, must eventually bring out what was held from the beginning by the occult original consciousness in things of which it is a gradual manifestation. In life, it would be clearly hopeless to seek for the truth, for life begins with a formulation in which consciousness is still submental and, therefore, to us as mental beings, appears as inconscient or at most subconscious, and our own investigation into this stage of life, studying it from outside, cannot be more fruitful of the secret truth than our examination of matter. Even when mind develops in life, its first functional aspect is a mentality involved in action, in vital and physical needs and preoccupations, in impulses, desires, sensations, emotions, unable to stand back from these things and observe and know them. In the human mind, there is the first hope of understanding, discovery, a free comprehension. Here we might seem to be coming to the possibility of self-knowledge and world knowledge. But in fact, our mind can at first only observe facts and processes, and for the rest it has to make deductions and inferences, to construct hypotheses, to reason, to speculate. In order to discover the secret of consciousness, it would have to know itself and determine the reality of its own being and process. But as in animal life, the emerging consciousness is involved in vital action and movement, so in the human being, mind consciousness is involved in its own world of thoughts and activity in which it is carried on without rest and in which its very reasonings and speculations are determined in their tendency, trend, conditions by its own temperament, mental turn, past formation and line of energy, inclination, preference, and inborn natural selection. We do not freely determine our thinking according to the truth of things. It is determined for us by our nature. We can indeed stand back with a certain detachment and observe the workings of the mental energy in us, but it is still only its process that we see and not any original source of our mental determinations. We can build theories and hypotheses of the process of mind, but a veil is still there over the inner secret of ourselves, our consciousness, our total nature.
So here, as we see from this paragraph on, he's looking for the validity for this hypothesis. And so that's the whole thing about whether he finds this hypothesis to be sufficient, cause to itself, or is he going to look for some validity? And so what are we going to look for validity? Where are we going to search for this validity? And here is where he introduces this notion of the limits of freedom in each of these layers of consciousness, that it is, again, consciousness or the energy, or the chit shakti, which is providing a certain kind of level of determination in which the truth of the determination is the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti. And that is understandable through the degree of freedom Purusha has in it. What are the instruments provided for some space of standing aside, of feeling free within the determinate? This is exactly what is going to decide the radical shift in properties from level to level of consciousness, why we call it differences in kind rather than in degree. Though to Brahman, these are only differences in degree. See, these are, there's another very interesting Enlightenment philosopher who coined the term perennial philosophy. This is Leibniz, who talks about the fold. And, you know, these are the two great philosophers that Deleuze sort of draws on. And the reason he draws on this notion of the fold is exactly this, that each one of these layers is just a degree, a difference in degree for Brahman, but can be thought of as a fold. In other words, it is a fold in which certain properties are focused, and those properties then are part of that world that is manifest in that fold. But another fold becomes a different kind of manifestation of Brahman and has its own variations within it. But it is nevertheless Brahman and nothing but Brahman that is self-presenting itself in each of these. And the degree to which it can be present to itself as self-conscious, as something which has independence and knows itself to be manifesting itself, is varying in grades. And so that's the reason why in matter we find that whatever we can call Purusha is so deeply asleep that we cannot discover in itself this particular reality. Now, the emergence of the Purusha in each of these planes has also been studied, and that's what the entire field of yoga is all about. Emergence of the physical Purusha is also possible, and that's what, you know, I would like to acknowledge the whole field of Hatha Yoga, for example, that has been developed, and that Just yesterday, a very great teacher, V.K.S. Iyengar, passed on, and he was one of the really true great ones who made that entire field open, and his students are all over the world now propagating that field of yoga. And the idea there is that the physical Purusha can emerge and we can experience it, but nevertheless its relations of the physical Purusha with the physical Prakriti will always be such that the physical Purusha and the physical Prakriti will not be able to manifest beyond a certain degree the totality of Brahman. And as he points out over here, in nature, the physical nature is so deeply asleep that the physical Purusha is very deeply within, not able to know its own secrets. It is as if, again, by automatism, like a sleepwalker. Sri Aurobindo uses the word somnambulist, which means a sleepwalker, that the body carries out its automatic functions so well. It's by a kind of a natural grace that the body carries out all its automatic functions, working out the truths of being. But then he's pointing to the fact that even when we move to living sort of creatures, there is a consciousness that is more self-aware, but still its self-awareness is captured within its necessities, its drives and necessities to live, which ultimately are expressing to manifest the truth of immortality, to manifest the truth of that which is eternal and immortal, and so that's manifest through its need to continue living, both as a form as well as in other forms or through other forms, and at the same time to manifest the ability to become whole, to be able to know things. And so here, at the level of life, it is necessities and drives that capture the entirety of the attention of the Purusha, and cannot know itself outside that. And then with the human being, we have a gradation of mind. Mind emerges in the animal itself, but it's as if a certain new fold of the manifestation of Brahman takes place with the human, where the amount of mind, the quantum of mind present in the human, allows it to express a degree of freedom for the Purusha that is much greater than anything known so far. And that's why the principle of intelligence can study things. We can study outside of the needs of the body or the life force, the world around us. And yet, there too there are automatisms, processes, and forms of thinking within which the operation of the Purusha is captured and cannot escape. So, to answer this question, what is needed to validate this hypothesis? He's pointing out that we have to rise to a point where that particular process makes itself known. And at this point, we still haven't got to that point. With mind, we can propose a hypothesis, but we cannot validate it. This is what he's saying. Yes.
I have a question. If I can orient it right, does the study of this principle allow more of that awareness to emerge?
Yeah, the idea is absolutely, the idea is that to find a lever, to find a handle, a vantage, where can we start to find an adequate lever or vantage? And then if we can find such an adequate lever or vantage, how can we apply it to unlock the sleeper within? And in a sense, we can look at these paragraphs, and particularly this last paragraph, in terms of the meditations of Bhrigu in the Taittiriya Upanishad, where Bhrigu is asked the question, what then is Brahman? And or he himself asks the question, what then is Brahman? And he meditates in successively, and first says that matter is Brahman, life is Brahman, mind is Brahman. And he is sent back by his father to meditate again until he arrives at the notion that delight is Brahman. But this delight, of course, is the ananda of Satchidananda. That is pure conscious delight, or consciousness as delight. And it's only at that point that his father will say to him that, yes, he will not send him back again, because that is the adequate lever. And now he'll say to him, okay, now go down and re-realize mind as Brahman, life as Brahman, as matter as Brahman, using this new principle that you found, because that will unlock those potencies which didn't allow you to know what the truth of these things are, and that they are the same as the truth that you found. The differences in kind are differences in degree, only at a certain degree. That's the vantage that he's looking for.
So he's really advocating practice.
Of course, he's advocating practice, and as you'll see from the next paragraph, he'll enter into practice, he'll tell you how to go there, but at the same time, he's saying that until you can't validate this until you get to the right level. That does not mean you can't start your practice at another level. You see, he's trying to answer a question, but at the same time, he's pointing to the fact that there are ways by which we can know this, and there are ways by which we can open the paths to knowing this. That's what he's doing here.
I mean, I'm kind of relating this to your mention of Aditya Iyengar and Hatha Yoga, and
yes,
also my experience of working for many years as a dancer.
Yes,
and that there is definitely a physical, that is definitely knowledge that comes from the physical.
Yes,
but that it takes a long time to understand how to receive it and interpret it.
Yes.
And it seems like there are many ways of many ways in which that practice can manifest.
Yes.
Emergence of different of truth.
Correct. No doubt. And there are many ways. And as you said, it's through skill of the body that we can explore the limits of this and know that freedom of the self within, in the body itself.
So how does this relate to the way the mother talks about bringing things down to the cells?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. So that emergence of the Purusha, if we talk about Hatha Yoga, for example, or other ways by which secret knowledge can emerge through the body or manifest through the body, is still relative. There are still, kind of sleeping depths that are unawoken, so to say. And ultimately, the two major properties that are trying to manifest themselves through all this is, one is the emergence of the true person, the total person, Purushottama, the emergence of the Purushottama in individuals. And the second is not only the emergence in some kind of subtle body, but in the body. It's a full physical emergence of the Purusha. And the second is the permanent emergence of the Purusha, because a property of the Purusha is eternity, and eternity translated to the physical is immortality. So conscious immortal bodies housing the totality of consciousness in a specific form is the goal of individuation. And that can only happen if not only whatever is possible within the body's own limits of consciousness are opened up, but until that highest truth is brought down and the doors unlocked for that level of consciousness to manifest as matter, as body. Yeah, this is a very important point, actually, this whole thing about, that's the whole issue of levels of access. And in a way, we could talk about two things. One is, let's say, the Hegelian notion in which consciousness is emerging through gradations, but none of the gradations only offer themselves as experimental grounds through which a higher synthesis is possible, but nothing changes, whatever is achieved remains there. So these are all static, and we can talk about levels of consciousness that are static, that are like launching pads for something higher, which opens up a hierarchical notion of consciousness. It's only on the peaks that we can know, and the rest of it will always only remain kind of pedestal, basis. And the other end of things is that you know everything is always in each of them, so what is preventing us from opening up the full possibilities at that level itself? And Sri Aurobindo is taking a certain position between these, where he's saying everything is fully present in each level, but the degrees of access are severely limited due to this is the cosmic manifestation of consciousness. So only a certain degree is possible until one brings in some other power to unlock those other degrees. And that's where he's saying we are not here to enter into the transcendental and leave the material behind, but we are not here also to, you know, allow just whatever exists in the material to stay where it is. We are here to enlarge the capacities of each of these and also transform them. That's where the whole notion of bringing a transcendence into the immanent to transform it comes in. So he is saying that the fullness of Brahman is present in each of its layers, but that these layers are interacting, and that interaction can ultimately lead to a dynamic that can transform the lower layers. But for that, just as mind has its certain influence on the body, and body has its influence on the mind, higher powers of consciousness, higher layers of consciousness have to be opened up that have their influence on mind and body, and ultimately can completely divinize them, or can allow them to be divinized, let's say.
Devashish?
Yes.
Can I ask you if there is another companion piece from Sri Aurobindo, yes, where he also speaks about this, that we could look for another reference, perhaps someplace in the synthesis of yoga or in another work, where he's speaking directly about this issue?
I'll have to look for it, Owen, but I think it'll be there, not only in synthesis, but here in the Life Divine itself, There are other chapters in which this will be made much clearer.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll give you an answer by next time or privately by email.
Thank you.
Yeah. So send it to everybody if you
can. Okay, sure, I will. It's even in his letters, he has some letters where he makes this very clear in a succinct form. So I'll look for that and I'll send it to the group.
Thank you.
So shall we, it's 9:30, but do we want to read one more paragraph and perhaps leave the discussion for that to next time, Devashilka?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Let's do that. That'll allow us to have a kind of an opening to that paragraph, and we'll take it up next time.
Sure. So this is the paragraph starting with, it is only when. Daniel Harris, would you like to read next? Hello? He's not there. Maybe John Robert?
Hello?
Yeah, oh, are you on? Yes.
Yeah, I thought I clicked my mic and I didn't. Yeah. Okay. It is only when we follow the yogic process of quieting the mind itself that a profounder result of our self-observation becomes possible. For first, we discover that mind is a subtle substance, a general determinant, or a generic indeterminate, which mental energy, when it operates, throws into forms or particular determinations of itself, thoughts, concepts, precepts, mental sentiments, activities of will, and reactions of feeling, but which, when the energy is quiescent, can live either in an inert torpor, or in an immobile silence and peace of self-existence. Next, we see that the determinations of our mind do not all proceed from itself, for waves and currents of mental energy enter into it from outside. These take form in it or appear already formed from some universal mind or from other minds and are accepted by us as our own thinking. We can perceive also an occult or subliminal mind in ourselves from which thoughts and perceptions and will impulses and mental feelings arise. We can perceive two higher planes of consciousness from which a superior mind energy works through us or upon us. Finally, we discover that which observes all this is a mental being, supporting the mind substance and mind energy. Without this presence, the upholder and source of sanctions, they could not exist or operate. This mental being, or Purusha, first appears as a silent witness, and if that were all, we would have to accept the determinations of mind as a phenomenal activity imposed upon the being by nature, by Prakriti, or else as a creation presented to it by Prakriti. A world of thought which nature constructs and offers to the observing Purusha. But afterwards, we find that the Purusha, the mental being, can depart from its posture of a silent or accepting witness. It can become the source of reactions, accept, reject, even rule and regulate, become the giver of the command, the knower. The knowledge also arises that this mind substance manifests the mental being. It is its own expressive substance, and the mental energy is its own conscious force. So that it is reasonable to conclude that all mind determinations arise from the being of the Purusha. But this conclusion is complicated by the fact that from another viewpoint, our personal mind seems to be little more than a formation of universal mind, an engine for the reception, modification, propagation of cosmic thought waves, idea currents, will suggestions, waves of feeling, sense suggestions, form suggestions. It has no doubt its own already realized expression, predispositions, propensities, personal temperament, and nature. What comes from the universal can only find a place there if it is accepted and assimilated into the self-expression of the individual mental being. The personal prakriti, or purusha, but still, in view of these complexities, the question remains entire whether all this evolution and action is a phenomenal creation by some universal energy presented to the mental being, or an activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence, or whether the whole is something predetermined by some dynamic truth or self within, and only manifested in the mind surface. To know that we would have to touch or to enter into the cosmic state of being and consciousness to which the totality of things and their integral principle would be better manifest than to our limited mind existence.
So we can revisit that paragraph in which there is a lot, because there is the beginning of a deeper consideration here. He's pushing us out of our normal experience into the yogic world from this paragraph. And he's raising a very, very profound question, which also pertains to his evolutionary hypothesis, which is that even at the yogic level, our mind experience leaves us with a question mark, which has to do with the degree of freedom of mind and its ability to perceive mental energy and its operations and yet be separate from it. And the question is it arising from within? Does it belong to us? Or is it outside us? Is it cosmic? And in this question also lies hidden the fact that though we do manifest a certain mind consciousness and can be free from the mental operations through the awareness of a mental self or Purusha, this mental self or Purusha is clearly not yet the complete mental self or Purusha, the one which is the origin from which the world of thought arises. And I think with that we can contemplate what that implies, and we can take it up next time. When are we meeting next?
So that should be today is August 23rd, and so this should be 6th September, I suppose.
Okay.
So we
is it alternate Saturdays, or is it two Saturdays a month?
Yeah, I thought it was second and fourth. Actually, there's already been a little bit of deviation because we started with last Saturday of the month, and then I think now it has shifted to second and fourth Saturdays.
Actually, that last Saturday was also a fourth Saturday, so it
That's
didn't
right.
really bother it that way.
So then perhaps, do we want to do it on 6th or the 13th?
I think let's keep it the 13th, because then we'll be maintaining 2nd and 4th. Let's make that the rule. rather than every second and fourth Saturday, we can fix.
Okay.
Yeah, most of the time it'll be alternate Saturdays. It's just August has five Saturdays, that's why.
So let's plan to get together 13th September, and I'll send out the recording for this later today.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. We'll convene next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.